Women in the Making of America.
America of today echoes the words spoken by Noah Webster 150 years ago.
In a Republican government, we must have the whole power of education, a system that will give every citizen an opportunity of acquiring knowledge, fitting him for places of trust.
Yet, when Webster spoke, one half of the citizens of America were forbidden to attend any of our high schools or colleges. That half was the women. Today we bring you the story of their struggle for the privilege to share in America's education. And at the close of this program, we shall present as our guest speaker, Miss Constance Warren, president of Sarah Lawrence College, one of today's Women in the Making of America. Ever since the beginning of time, mankind has been struggling against his great enemy, ignorance. And yet today, right here in America, ignorance still stalks the land, and men and women are still pioneering against it. Down in the mountains of Georgia, a white-haired woman bends over a hand-hewn desk. Martha Berry, founder of the Piney Woods Schools. Beside her sits another woman, her bony fingers painfully wriggling a pencil in unaccustomed lines and curves.
That's right. A, M. No, no. Three bumps for the M.
Land sakes, seems like your two would be enough. Reckon I never will learn this writing business, Miss Berry.
Why, of course you will. You're doing beautifully. Now, S. There, that's right. Well, there it is.
Is that it? Does that say Martha Williams?
That's it.
Land sakes, I can't hardly believe it. At last I've got an education. I've written my own name.
Americans, descendants of some of the earliest settlers, yet 300 years behind the rest of the country in education. Early America inherited a rich bequest from Europe, the treasured knowledge of centuries of civilization. A tradition as old as time, echoing down the ages from the wisdom of Greece, from the lips of Plato.
All the pursuits of men are the pursuits of women. The gifts of nature are alike diffused in both. Women ought to share in education and in other ways with men.
An age-old tradition that women should share with men in learning and self-expression. And in some colonies, they did share. In those that inherited the monastic tradition of education.
In St. Augustine, where America's first school was opened in 1594.
In Quebec, where priests and nuns established their missions.
But the land between was to be the scene of a struggle for equal opportunities in schooling. 1647. In the colony of Massachusetts Bay, the Council of Elders proclaims a law.
So that learning may not be buried in the graves of our forefathers, we order that every township of 50 householders shall appoint one to teach all such children as shall report to him to write and read. And every town of 100 homes shall provide a Latin grammar school to instruct youth so they shall be fitted for the university.
But only boys were included in that law. The girls sat with the younger children in the dame schools, learning their letters from some village woman who had turned her kitchen into a schoolroom.
Quiet, children. Now, before the girls start to embroider their samplers, we will review the alphabet. Nathaniel Higginson.
A, B, C, D, D.
Yes, go on.
D. I don't know what comes next.
I know, Mistress Brewster.
Deborah.
B-E-F-T-H-I-J-K-L-M-N-N.
Very nice. That's enough. Charity. Will you go on from there?
Charity?
Oh?
What have you to say to Master Brown that's more important than the alphabet?
Well, he says that boys are smarter than girls and that I can't ever go to Latin school or the university.
I'm afraid that's true.
But he's not smarter. I know my catechism much better than he does. Why can't I go?
Because you're a girl, Charity.
And you can't teach there either, can you, Mr. Spruster?
No. No, I can't.
But why?
Because I'm a woman.
Because she was a woman. The reason that was to keep her out of America's universities for 200 years.
But though the door to formal education was closed to them, the daughters of America still managed to learn.
And the wives and mothers of America managed to educate themselves, reading widely and discussing their ideas with their friends and husbands. Some of them even wrote important books. But when one of those writers happened to go insane, Governor Winthrop was ready with an explanation.
If she had attended to her household affairs and such things as belong to women, and had not gone out of her way to meddle in such things as are proper for men whose minds are stronger, she'd have kept her wits and might have improved them usefully and honorably in the place God had set her.
Still, women continue to read and write and talk and wonder. Their letters rich with dreams of a better life, a freer America, wider opportunity. Yet, 150 years later, Abigail Adams was writing to her husband at the Continental Congress.
It is certain that the well-informed woman is more capable of retaining the affections of a man than one whose intellect rises not above the common level. Yet, here in America, female education is neglected, and it is fashionable to ridicule female learning.
Female learning.
We, the Board of Admission for Yale University, wish to report that on the 22nd day of December, 1783, Miss Lucinda Foote, age 12, was examined in the learned languages of Latin and Greek and was found fully qualified to enter Yale. Except in regard to sex, therefore, she may not enter.
Female education.
Miss Martha Gazley wishes to announce the opening of a select seminary for young ladies, where they may learn ciphering, French, and all the polite accomplishments, including embroidery, making wax ornaments, and playing on the harpsichord, all taught in the genteelest and most elegant manner.
That was the best schooling America had to offer. No high schools, no colleges. Emma Willard, schoolteacher, is asking a question of the New York legislature. Beautiful, poised, queenly, she stands before them.
Why shouldn't women study advanced subjects freely?
Why? Because their brains are too light, their foreheads too small, their reasoning powers too poor, and their emotions too unstable. Women will never make good students. No, no, no.
But I've already proved that they will. I've been teaching them in my home, philosophy and geography.
It would ruin a woman's health to study such things.
Women were meant to be charming, not intelligent.
Gentlemen, if you will only grant my request for $2,000 to found a female academy...
Why don't you ask for a woman's college?
I don't believe in sending women to college any more than you do. But I do ask for a higher education than they have now.
Will higher education make women any better cooks or seamstresses?
It will make them better teachers and mothers of children.
Oh, nonsense. It'll only make them more ambitious. If women get an education, there's no telling what they'll want.
That's the truth.
It will upset the whole order of things.
Governor Clinton, I appeal to you.
I believe in your plan, Mrs. Willard. Gentlemen, this is the only attempt ever made in this country to promote female education by the patronage of the government.
It's a waste of public money.
She's interfering with the will of God.
I vote no.
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 But Emma Willard had taken the first step toward a higher education for American women. Eventually, she was to attain her academy and instruct hundreds of younger Americans to continue the march.
You owe it to your country to teach, for a few years at least. Go into the West and the South. Spread the knowledge you've gained. Freedom of learning is a human right. We must win that right for all America.
America kept marching on. In the western land of Ohio, where liberty was the breath of life, a college had dared to open its doors to women.
Oberlin College has established a department for the elevation of female character by bringing within the reach of the misguided and neglected sex all the instruction privileges which have hitherto unreasonably distinguished the leading sex from theirs.
And now from Georgia, Daniel Candler makes a plea.
Women should have the same educational opportunities as men do. Americans, this is the most important matter that's ever engaged your attention. We must establish a female college.
Bah! All a woman needs to know is to read the New Testament and to cook and to sew.
College education would ruin women's health and morals.
What degree are you going to give them? B.A.? Bachelorette of applesauce?
M.S.B., Mistress of the Scrubbing Brush.
But neither antagonism nor ridicule could stop the march of public democratic education. On went the little band of pioneers, carving a new frontier through the wilderness of ignorance. 1837. Another woman is leading now, one who knows the value of education. At 17, Mary Lyon had taught school for 75 cents a week, and had saved enough to take herself to an academy. Now, at 40, she was still working for the realization of a long-cherished dream.
I want to establish a school where poor girls can learn to teach.
Nonsense. They'll only educate them out of their class and make them dissatisfied.
But they have a right to learn.
Nope, not a penny. Not a penny will you get from me for such a ridiculous scheme. Good day.
I believe that all women should have the opportunity for higher education.
And I believe that no woman should. She'll just get married anyway. Then what good will an education do her? Or, worse still, she won't get married. Men hate intelligent women.
Yes, I am soliciting funds for a school. Years now I've been doing it, but I guess people just don't want one.
Well, I ain't got much, ma'am, only 87 cents. But I know what a school like that would have done for me, so...
Thank you. Thank you very much.
When Mary Lyon founded Mount Holyoke, her account book showed a total of $27,000. 1,300 contributions from 6 cents up, garnered from people in 91 different towns. 1,300 Americans who believed in freedom of education. By 1840, America had made vast strides in her march against ignorance. And according to the census,
over 90% of the white men and women of America can read and write.
And in 7 states of the Union, more women can write than men.
Another woman was leading now, Catherine Beecher, sister of Harriet Beecher Stowe. Catherine pioneered in 2 directions, westward, establishing colleges in the raw new cities of the Mississippi Valley, and outward, broadening the curriculum. In her schools, girls studied strange new subjects, and parents came to complain.
Miss Beecher, what's this I hear about Juliana studying bending?
Bending?
Yeah, she says somebody plays the piano, and Somebody else counts time, and she just stands there and tries to touch the floor.
Oh, you mean calisthenics.
That's it, Henry. Calisthenics.
Well, what I want to know is what that's got to do with education.
Well, you see, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, we feel that it's just as important to train the body as it is the mind. If the future mothers of America have strong, healthy bodies...
It's tomfoolery, Miss Beecher. I ain't going to pay out good money for you to learn my daughter.
Teach your daughter, Henry.
Well, anyhow, I ain't a-going to do it. Not if Juliana don't ever learn to touch the floor.
But in spite of objections, calisthenics remained in the program for the women of America, the forerunner of active sports.
But Catherine Beecher's greatest contribution, like that of Emma Willard and Mary Lyon before her, was in training teachers, to found more schools to train more teachers. For it was the teachers who led the march of education.
...1853. The New York State Teachers Convention is meeting at Rochester. For hours, the male members have been debating as to why their profession is not considered on a par with theology, medicine, or law. Suddenly, a woman in the gray garb of a Quaker rises to speak.
Mr. President.
A woman. Speaking out loud in a teacher's convention.
The bold creature. Who can she be?
President Davies, may I speak on the subject under discussion?
Well, what is the pleasure of the convention?
I move she be heard. I second the motion.
It has been moved and seconded that this lady be allowed to speak. All in favor?
Aye.
If we women teachers could vote, we'd keep her quiet.
Opposed?
No.
The motion has been passed, and Miss...
Miss Susan B. Anthony.
Miss Anthony has the floor.
Don't you see, gentlemen, that so long as society says a woman is incompetent to be a lawyer, minister, or doctor, but has ample ability to be a teacher, every man of you who chooses this profession tacitly acknowledges that he has no more brains than a woman? If you would make teaching more lucrative, then increase the salaries of the women engaged in the noble work of educating our future presidents, senators, and congressmen.
The nerve of her. I feel positively mortified.
It's a disgrace to our sex.
No, there are three men shaking hands with her.
Yeah,
well, oh, please.
Susan B. Anthony had made her first public declaration for women's rights. And though her Victorian sisters were ashamed of her, the men saw the justice of her plea.
It was evident that she had hit the nail on the head. Her suggestion would raise the prestige of the entire profession.
But teaching would long remain the chief profession for women, one where they would eventually far outnumber the men. And the more they taught, the more women were able to study
in the Georgia Female College at Macon.
In Vassar College at Poughkeepsie.
In the coeducational colleges of the Middle West.
In the church colleges built by the Moravians, Friends, Baptists, Catholics, Lutherans.
...1869. In Hatfield, Massachusetts, in the Victorian parlor of a fine new house on Main Street, a little old lady sits stiffly erect on her horsehair sofa. Sophia Smith, the richest woman in town. Her tin ear trumpet is curved toward her visitor.
And so I've called you here, George Hubbard, to help me make out my will. I haven't had much schooling myself.
Nonsense, Sophia. You're one of the educatedest women in Hatfield.
Eh? What's that?
I say you've had a fine education.
Education? Is that what you call it? 12 weeks at the Hartford Academy. That's all I could get. And anyhow, you don't have to yell at me. I'm not as deaf as a doorknob.
Of course you're not, Sophia. Now,
Now, folks think that just because a body's got an ear trumpet...
Now, Sophia, about this will of yours. You know, Hatfield needs a new town hall.
And I'm leaving $450,000 to build a college for women.
A college for women? Sophia Smith, why, that's ridiculous. It's rank extravagance.
Sorry, George, I can't hear a thing you're saying. A woman's college, that's what it's going to be.
In Smith College. Vassar and Bryn Mawr were soon to follow. Then Columbia and Harvard, where girls had been sneaking into classes and hurrying home to study in secret. A new type of school was born. The woman's college that shares the studies and professors of a man's university, Barnard and Radcliffe. And when one of the girls had to leave school because of ill health, President Barnard was pelted with all the old arguments.
You see, Barnard, women aren't able to study such things as physics. Even President Eliot of Harvard says their minds are different from men's.
Nonsense. What of the girls that ruin their health being debutantes? I'd far rather see a woman studying physics than earning a QS degree as queen of society.
Dr. Barnard, I believe in preserving the bloom on the peach as long as possible.
So do I, madam. So do I. I would favor no measure which would leave the slightest trace upon the delicacy of the bloom. But I would have the peach valuable for something more than its beauty.
Frederick Barnard, Horace Mann, Matthew Vassar. They were brave men who dared to champion women's education. Women had won freedom of education and proved their right to it. But while hundreds of women went to college, ignorance still stalked the land of America. And still other women were pioneering against it.
In the South, Lucy Laney had established Haynes Institute for the Education of Negroes.
In the North, Mother Frances Cabrini was founding schools for the education of Italian immigrants.
In the mountains, Martha Berry was teaching eighth-generation Americans to read and write, to build houses and weave clothing and plant crops, to study for college.
Men, women, and children sharing in the birthright of America, of unhampered freedom to learn. By 1936, there were 1,275 colleges in America, most of them coeducational.
218 men's colleges.
240 women's.
637,000 men's students.
389,000 women.
And though women had been barred from the honorary scholastic fraternity of Phi Beta Kappa till 100 years after its founding, they were now wearing 40% of its golden keys. ...1936... 150 years after Lucinda Foote was refused a college education, a woman is receiving an honorary degree from Columbia University. As she stands before President Nicholas Murray Butler, thousands of Americans lean forward to hear his words.
Ellen Fitz Pendleton, native of New Hampshire, graduated at Wellesley College a half century ago, able now to look back with happy satisfaction upon a long and useful career as college teacher and administrator. For a full quarter century, president of Wellesley College, guiding and stimulating thousands of American women on their course through life, finely illustrating Longfellow's lines,
"A lady with a lamp shall stand on the great history of the land, a noble type of good, heroic womanhood."
And now it is our privilege to meet one of the outstanding educators of today, Miss Constance Warren, who will be interviewed by Mrs. Eva Hansel. Mrs. Hansel.
As Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York, is one of the newer colleges pioneering in the education of young women, we have asked its president, Miss Constance Warren, to participate in this program. Miss Warren, do you think men have cause to regret that the women of America may now have all the education they want?
No, indeed, Mrs. Hansel. I think men are benefited by women's higher education almost as much as women are. In the first place, it makes women much more companionable. Husbands probably talk over a great many more things with their wives today than their fathers and grandfathers did. Politics and business and international affairs, even money matters.
But now, Miss Warren, that women are interested in things outside their traditional home sphere, does that mean that the home is neglected?
Oh, on the contrary. As women study the world in which they are living, they get a new perspective on the home and discover new values they want to put into it.
Tell me, Miss Warren, do most of your graduates plan to be married or to work for a living?
Oh, both, as a matter of course. They all want to try their hands at earning their living, not only to feel independent of their families, but because they want to be part of the working world, in order to understand it, and men better. The Depression taught many of them that they cannot marry unless they are prepared to share the financial burden, or if necessary, to become the only breadwinner in the family.
Can a college prepare a girl for a job and for home life at the same time, Miss Warren?
Oh, there's no great split between preparation for domesticity and for business as we see it, Mrs. Hansel. The same fundamentals of character and working habits count in both. Courage, assurance, a fine sense of proportion, willingness to take responsibility, the ability to think clearly and to meet people easily.
But what about the new growing prejudice against married women in business we're hearing so much about these days?
Oh, that doesn't frighten them. They know that as women they still have to be better than men to get a job, and that as married women they have to be even better to hold it.
Then you don't agree with the fathers and the employers who protest it is a waste of time and money to educate a woman, do you, Miss Warren?
Oh, of course, there's a certain amount of waste in education. There has to be, Mrs. Hansel, in men's as well as women's careers. It'd be interesting to find out how many men trained in law, journalism, or engineering are working today in other fields. Does anybody accuse them of wasting their education? What is lost when a woman has been trained for an occupation, marries, and returns to private life is a skill. When a scientific research worker marries and moves to a place where there is no laboratory, for instance, she has to cease functioning as a worker in science. But that does not mean that her education is wasted, does it? Her understanding of the scientific basis of life will doubtless make her a better mother, and if her studies mean something vital to her, a better person. That is really the crux of the whole matter.
Thank you, Miss Warren.
Freedom of Education, the story of Catherine Beecher, Emma Willard, and Mary Lyon, the fifth in the series Women in the Making of America, is a program devoted to pioneer women in the history of our country. Women in the Making of America, based on an idea of Eva Hansel, is written by Jane Ashman and directed by Frederick Way. The incidental musical score is composed and arranged by Leith Stevens and the orchestra conducted by Joseph Hunty. If you would like a copy of this broadcast, it may be purchased by sending 10 cents along with your request to the National Broadcasting Company. Next week, Freedom of Citizenship, the story of Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Alice Paul. Mrs. Carrie Chapman Catt of the National American Woman Suffrage Association will be our guest. Women in the Making of America is a presentation of the Federal Theater Radio Division, a project of the Works Progress Administration, in association with the Women's Activities Department of the National Broadcasting Company.